This is CBC News.
Good evening. I'm Derek Stoffel.
And I'm Allison Smith. This is The World at 6.
Tonight, marketing magic or boondoggle?
Canadians are asking simple questions like, we spent $1 billion and all we got was this lousy fake lake.
Rising anger over Ottawa's summit spending.
Cell phones in the cells.
What we seize and what's actually in there, nobody can really say.
Prison officials grapple with contraband communicators.
And the mother of that baby killed in a dog mauling now faces a charge of manslaughter. But first tonight, here's Allison with our top story.
It's the stuff of splashy headlines. That fake lake is continuing to make waves. The ankle-deep reflecting pool is part of the Toronto Media Centre for the upcoming G8 and G20 summits. Initial reports put the price tag at $2 million, something the Conservatives are now scrambling to correct. But as we hear from Susan Lunn, the opposition says their explanations just don't hold water.
Daily question period. And once again, the opposition spent most of its time on the rising cost of the summits. Liberal Mark Holland listed off the examples.
A boat, $40,000. Distant gazebos and bathrooms, $300,000.
And then there's that fake lake with a large TV screen nearby to show the World Cup.
What else are they hiding? How much more crazy does this thing get?
The government spent much of its time in question period clarifying some of the numbers. The fake lake cost $57,000. It's the entire Experience Canada Pavilion within the Media Centre that costs almost $2 million. And Prime Minister Stephen Harper says it's more than a place for reporters.
When in fact, Mr. Speaker, what there is a $2 million marketing pavilion, Mr. Speaker. There are thousands of visitors from around the world. This is a classic attempt for us to be able to market the country.
Harper also said most of the total cost of the two summits, now almost $1 billion, is being spent on one thing.
Well, Mr. Speaker, of course, as we've said, the vast majority of costs are for security arrangements that are similar to other summits, Mr. Speaker, and these are essential.
But pollster Nick Nanos says the public isn't convinced. He says there are two reasons why they are so upset with how much money the government is spending on these two meetings.
People would think that the Conservatives would be better based on their track record. And second of all, you know, Canadians are very concerned about spending taxpayers' dollars and what type of value for money they're realistically going to receive for playing host to the world.
And NDP leader Jack Layton says there are better ways to spend $2 million to convince people to visit Canada's wilderness.
I don't think you attract tourists with a fake lake or a big TV screen. I'm sorry, Canada's got more to offer than that.
Nanos says the Conservatives can try to deflect this daily criticism by being completely transparent about why the costs have gone up so much. Even still, he thinks the billion-dollar summit will likely be one of the things people will remember from Stephen Harper's time as Prime Minister. Susan Lunn, CBC News, Ottawa.
The fake lake isn't the only summit project making a splash. Over the past year, the government has poured $50 million into a wide area around the G8 summit site near Huntsville. Derek went up there recently to a small community south of the actual G8 summit site.
Port Sydney is a tiny little town tucked in between the fir trees on Mary Lake. It's also where Tony Clement, the industry minister, has a home. On a hot spring afternoon, a group of teenagers from the town is out enjoying one of the improvements paid for by the G8 Infrastructure Fund. Port Sydney's dock has been spruced up. The wood's been replaced. There's a fresh coat of varnish. Just up the beach, the toilets and changing area have also been renovated. In all, $250,000 was spent in Port Sydney to fix up the beach and put in a new parking lot at the community center. Resident Monta Suter doesn't hesitate when I ask her what the G8's legacy will be.
I think pride in our town and a lot of wonderful buildings.
But who will see all these buildings? The G8 leaders are meeting at a resort in Huntsville, almost 30 kilometers away. Chris Zanetti owns the general store on Port Sydney's Main Street. He also chairs the town's finance committee. Zanetti is an optimist. His fingers are crossed that maybe the world leaders will drop by.
Coming down to Port Sydney, we certainly hope they will. We have an ice cream cone waiting for President Obama, and We welcome them, but I don't know if that'll happen.
Tony Clement defends the G8 infrastructure spending in his riding.
We have a tourism strategy for the district, and what you do when you have a summit or you have an Olympics, you have a big event in Canada, you want to leverage that for more tourism, for more business. That's what we've done in this case, just as has been done in many other cases as well.
All this G8 spending isn't being welcomed by everyone here. Resident Terry Gill says long after the G8 leaders leave town, the community will be stuck with the long-term maintenance costs for everything from the bathroom on the beach to the giant new ice rink up in Huntsville.
I have really no idea why they would hold it in such a small community. I really wouldn't be surprised that the town of Huntsville may go bankrupt because of the G8 being here.
So, Derek, you focused on Port Sydney. How widespread is the largesse?
It's right across the whole Muskoka region in cottage country in Ontario. A number of towns in the area, you drive through them, you'll see new sidewalks. They've been fixed up. Park benches have been placed around towns. And all over the place, there's been new flower boxes and all kinds of things to make it look very pretty for the world leaders. But, you know, talk to most officials and they say it's great that they have all this new stuff, but world leaders won't see it in the vast majority of cases.
Thanks for this, Derek. That billion-dollar security plan for the G8 and G20 summits has hit another snag. Turns out the Vancouver-based firm hired to carry out pedestrian screening doesn't have a license to operate in Ontario. The province is scrambling to give Contemporary Security Canada accreditation in time.
I'm Stephen Puddicombe in Halifax. Imagine a trip to Peggy's Cove, Cape Spear, or Raced Rocks, only to find out their lighthouses are gone. Ottawa says their days are numbered across the country.
And this is kind of the last chance we have to save these structures.
If that doesn't happen, more than 400 lighthouses across Canada will have their lights turned off permanently. That story later on The World at 6.
The Correctional Service of Canada has a problem in its prisons with cells, cell phones, that is. A CBC News investigation discovered they're valuable contraband, often used to commit even more crimes. Dave Seglins has the story.
Police Sergeant Jim Gorey retraces his steps north of Kingston, Ontario. It was here last June officers captured escaped murderer Andrew Wood.
Up the hill and just into the clearing is where his camp was located.
Gorey's with the Ontario Provincial Police, the penitentiary squad. He says Andrew Wood got out with help from the prison psychologist who'd fallen in love.
They were communicating via text messaging from inside the prison.
Psychologist Aaron Danto had slipped Wood a cell phone and helped him to flee to a remote forest to lie low.
There was an intimate relationship going on. You know, once Mr. Woods was out, they were going to get together.
But it never happened. After just 5 days, the pair were caught. The psychologist is now in jail herself for helping in the escape. Across the country, the number of cell phones smuggled into prisons is on the rise. Mike Hanley, warden at Drumheller Institution in Alberta, has seized 41 over the last year. Hands-free technology makes them hard to find.
When they're able to use earpieces and have the earpiece in one cell and the actual phone in the other. So even if we do get the guy in the process of making a call, we get the earpiece, but we may not get the cell phone.
What we seize and what's actually in there, nobody can really say.
Jim Gorey of the OPP says many go undetected, brought in by visitors, inmates on day passes, even prison staff. Now, inmates will pay more than $2,000 for a phone and then rent it out to others, $20, even $30 a minute. Gorey says guards need more than x-ray machines and pat-downs at prison entrances.
We'd like to see some type of jamming device installed in order to shut down the usage of cell phone within the prison.
It is pandemic proportion everywhere in the world.
Howard Malamed's company, Cell Antenna, has sold signal jamming devices to prisons in Europe and the Caribbean.
Our experience has been that jamming is really the pest control over here. It just eliminates them.
So far, federal regulators won't allow jamming. But today, Public Safety Minister Vic Taves called the situation unacceptable, and he pledged to get serious about stopping the flow of contraband cell phones into Canada's prisons. Dave Seglin, CBC News, Kingston, Ontario.
A Quebec teenager has been charged with manslaughter in the death of her three-week-old baby. The newborn was severely mauled by a dog at home in a farmhouse east of Montreal yesterday afternoon. As Justin Hayward reports, the young woman's lawyer and the baby's father are shocked by the charge.
Tears well up in Marie-Ève Goupil's eyes as she stands with a group of young people outside the St. Hyacinth courthouse. They're all friends of the 17-year-old mother being held in custody inside. Goupil has a toddler. Another woman has a newborn in a car seat. Goupil says she can't understand why the mother is being held. Most of the group are teens themselves, some barely into their 20s. Several have tattoos on their arms or necks. A 19-year-old man in a ragged AC/DC t-shirt steps forward. He says he's the baby's father and it's not the mother's fault.
C'est pas la faute de la mère. C'est un chien.
He says the mother and the baby's grandmother had put the newborn in a car seat in the same room as the dogs. They stepped outside on the balcony to have a cigarette. Then they heard something happening inside with the dogs. He says by the time the two women got back inside, the baby had been severely mauled. She was dead when police arrived. They arrested the mother and the grandmother soon after. In court, the young woman stood with her arms crossed, glancing briefly behind her at her family and the baby's father. Then, Crown prosecutors laid the charge. Manslaughter, because the mother had failed to provide the necessities of life for the newborn. André Williams is the mother's lawyer. He says he's shocked by the gravity of the charge and the speed with which it was laid.
Well, she's Detroit. She lost her child yesterday. She is 17 years old. So you can imagine how weak she is now.
The mother has been released. She'll be back in court in August. No charges were laid against the grandmother. The father says now he has to plan for the funeral.
J'ai quand même les funérailles de cet enfant à m'occuper. Et pour l'instant, je n'ai pas de salaire.
He says it's going to be hard because funerals are expensive, and at the moment, he doesn't have a job. Justin Hayward, CBC News, St. Hyacinth, Quebec.
As many as 1,000 Taliban prisoners held in Afghanistan, at least some of them captured by Canadian soldiers, may be released. Canadian military leaders say they're frustrated, but they're also resigned to the fact that some Taliban will walk free under a peace plan proposed by Afghan President Hamid Karzai. As the CBC's James Cudmore reports, Karzai's proposal is seen as a way to get the Taliban to agree to a peace process.
This is difficult. But if we can get it squared away, that will be the game changer.
The game changer in Afghanistan, in the view of General Walt Natinchek, is reconciliation. It's the process of bringing Taliban fighters into the government fold, either through concessions or bribery or the threat of defeat. But that threat has so far yielded few results, and last week, Afghan President Hamid Karzai held a massive peace meeting with tribal elders, designed to try and find another way to end decades of war. One of the outcomes of that meeting was a promise to free some Taliban prisoners. Yesterday, the chief of the defense staff told a Senate committee it was wise for countries like Canada not to prejudge those efforts.
The solution to this counterinsurgency has to be an Afghan solution. And I think all of us on the bleachers watching this, I think we've got to be very patient to see how this unfolds.
In Kandahar, the Canadian Forces hands its prisoners to Afghan authorities, who investigate, charge, and convict if they can. The Karzai plan allows a commission reporting to the president to decide which Taliban detainees should be freed. That leads to the prospect of fighters who have killed Canadian troops being let go.
It's not so much a question of principle anymore. It's a question of timing.
Military analyst Alain Pellerin says that would frustrate Canadian troops who only transfer prisoners they believe actually are Taliban. But he says sometimes the road to peace is a little windy.
At the end of the day, we don't have much choice.
The plan is controversial in Afghanistan, too. The head of the country's intelligence service has resigned, partly in protest, as did the minister responsible for police.
So we need to depower Taliban.
Today in Ottawa, former Afghan women's minister Masuda Jalal told MPs dealing with the Taliban is like dealing with the devil.
Well, negotiation with Taliban and trying to engage them with political power is empowerment of Taliban, is empowerment of extremism. His empowerment of religious dictatorship.
But it's where Karzai's headed. James Cudmore, CBC News, Ottawa.
They promise high-paying jobs, fast-tracked visas, and a chance to live in Canada. Those promises are often empty and the price high. Now the federal government wants to make them illegal. It's called the Cracking Down on Crooked Consultants Act. Philip Leshanek has more.
Before he came to Toronto from Singapore, Raoul Ballas didn't even know crooked consultants existed.
These should be warnings before they came here. They should know that they have a real employer, so when they came here, they can do their job.
Terry Aleto, who runs the Caregiver Resources Center, says he's one of the many foreign workers who've been taken advantage of by unscrupulous consultants. But while she hears the horror stories, she says few will step forward.
These recruiters are very smart in intimidating them. It's already scary to them because they are alone, they have no family, they have no job, they have to survive.
Immigration Minister Jason Kenney says the lack of complaints make it difficult to say how widespread the problem is.
Fraudulent immigration consultants don't report themselves to us. And so we only find out about it where there's really a very glaring case of abuse.
Kenney says the solution is to regulate the industry and make it a crime for unauthorized consultants, lawyers, and notaries to charge fees for immigration advice. Penalties include a $50,000 fine or up to 2 years in jail. Kenney also wants to create a new regulator to oversee immigration consultants. The existing governing body, the Canadian Society of Immigration Consultants, has been criticized for charging too much for membership, lacking transparency, and turning a blind eye to unscrupulous consultants in its own ranks. But it says it's moved to address Kenney's concerns and hopes to act as regulator under the new tougher rules. The New Democrats immigration critic, Olivia Chow, has some cautious support for the proposed changes.
It is tough. It makes it a criminal offense. It charges people and also would throw them in jail if convicted. But what we need to see is to make sure that there is resources to enforce the law.
She says with enough muscle behind the regulations, the system will gain the public's trust, and then foreign workers will feel more confident in stepping forward to complain that they've been ripped off. Philip Leshanok, CBC News, Toronto.
There have long been questions about the impact of body checking on kids playing hockey. Now, for the first time, a study has followed young players through a full season, tracking their contact on the ice and what happens as a result. It's been published in the respected Journal of the American Medical Association. Kelly Crow has the details.
It's tournament season for many elite kids' hockey teams in Canada. At this matchup in Toronto, there's lots of body checking among the 11 and 12-year-old players and plenty of enthusiasm.
When you check it, it just changes the whole game.
Just pump up your team. A check can make your team get more into the game.
Professor Carolyn Emery and her team followed about 1,000 players in Quebec and another 1,000 in Calgary. The researchers assigned trainers or sports therapists to each team involved, attended games, assessed the injuries, from bumps and bruises to fractures and concussions.
Well, the takeaway from this is that body checking in 11, 12-year-old players results in a significantly greater risk of injury and concussion than in a league where there's no body checking permitted.
Former NHLer Keith Primo knows all about it. He was forced to retire because of concussions. He can see the value in teaching kids early how to check as safely as possible.
But I also believe that there's some truth to the fact that if you're getting hit in the head at an earlier age, especially repetitive times, then they're it could cause problems down the road.
Emery says the findings also suggest there's more aggression on the ice when there's checking, more elbowing and slashing, for example. And the smallest, lightest players were the most likely to be the players hurt. She's a hockey player and coach herself.
We all know that this is a very controversial topic in ice hockey in Canada. I would say that the purpose of our study was to provide the most rigorous evidence that we could to help to inform the decision makers around this element of the game.
Hockey Canada oversees kids' hockey. Director of Development Paul Carson says the findings are not dramatic enough to warrant any immediate changes in policy.
My feeling is it's not that significant a number that there's a real concern at this point in terms of the safety of youngsters playing the game.
The researchers want to do a follow-up study, looking at an older group of players, more experienced with checking, to track their injuries.
Kelly Crow, CBC News, Toronto.
Some hopeful words from the head of the U.S. Federal Reserve calmed investors today on both sides of the border. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke says he's hopeful the American economy will gain traction and avoid a double-dip recession. That pushed stocks up in Toronto slightly. The TSX ended up 12 points higher at 11,517. In New York, the Dow jumped 123 points. The Nasdaq was down 3. The Canadian dollar got a big boost, ending the day up a full cent to close at 95.37 cents U.S.
General Motors is recalling about 1.5 million vehicles worldwide to address a problem with a heated windshield wiper system. It affects several models of pickup trucks, SUVs, and cars from 2006 to 2009. About 100,000 of them were sold in Canada. GM says the heated fluid systems could lead to a fire. This is the automaker's second recall on the same issue in 2 years.
U.S. government scientists have confirmed there are underwater plumes of oil in the Gulf of Mexico, something BP had previously denied. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says there are low concentrations of oil as deep as a kilometer beneath the surface. Scientists are now trying to confirm the oil comes from the BP well. Undersea oil depletes water of oxygen, threatening marine life.
The public anger toward BP is growing even faster than that oil slick, and nowhere faster than online. As Teresa Lalonde reports, millions are venting their rage over the leak's cost to the environment.
The online world is where many frustrated with watching the blackened birds and devastated beaches are going. 500,000 people have joined the Boycott BP Facebook page. They share pictures and video, and they collectively vent. There's even a bogus Twitter account, BP Global PR. It's full of satirical updates, such as the good news, mermaids are real, the bad news, they are now extinct. Greenpeace has an online campaign that asks people to design a new version of the BP flower logo. Ben Aliff is with Greenpeace UK.
So you have some that look very, very slick, play very cleverly on BP's logo, and they either change the colour slightly or it's dipped in oil, to using animals, to using death heads.
Aliff says they've had 600 entries so far. The winning entry will be used in a campaign to press BP to develop green energy. At least one environmental marketer thinks it's a misfire.
I don't see anybody stepping up and saying, all right, we're the windmill folks. We are the electric car folks. We are the solar power folks.
Mark Stoiber is VP of Green Innovation for Madoc Douglas. He says venting is a waste of time.
We do have our first green energy billionaire and Al Gore. And where are these people saying, guys, we now have enough alternative energy or clean energy that we could turn this horrific thing into almost innovation white space and say, now where does the future go?
Stoiber says it's better to seize this as an opportunity to take serious steps to move away from oil. So far, BP isn't fighting back. They haven't attempted to shut down the false Twitter account, saying people have the right to voice their frustration. Teresa Lalonde, CBC News, Vancouver.
Artificial snow was hauled into Winnipeg's Assiniboine Park Zoo today for an unusual ceremony. Officials held a snow turning for a $31 million International Polar Bear Rescue Center. When it's finished, the new facility will take in orphaned, injured, or problem polar bears. There are about 935 white Bruins living in the western Hudson Bay area. Many blame climate change for the dwindling population.
This is The World at 6 on CBC Radio 1.
We're on the internet at cbcnews.ca. Our latest podcast is at cbc.ca/podcasting.
We're also heard across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio 137 and around the world on Radio Canada International.
Daniel Lanois is in a Los Angeles hospital after a serious motorcycle crash over the weekend. The Canadian musician and producer has canceled an upcoming tour, including a performance next month at the Montreal Jazz Festival. A statement from his record label says Lanois is expected to spend the next 2 months recuperating. Lanois is best known for his work producing U2 and Bob Dylan. He's touring with a new group, Black Dub.
Lighthouses are the picture postcard icons of Canada's coastlines, but not for much longer. Ottawa wants to close down nearly 500 active lighthouses and replace them with less expensive steel towers. Stephen Puddicombe reports.
The images on Canada's east and west coasts are going to change if Ottawa gets its way. For many, Peggy's Cove, Race Rocks, or Cape Spear conjure images of thunderous waves crashing upon rocks, a lighthouse looking out over the sea. Fishermen Troy and Donald Gilkey say Ottawa is killing an important part of Canada's heritage and an important icon for their own family.
I think, well, our great-great-grandfather and stuff was...
Family history,
everything out there. We wouldn't want to see it, you know. Rather like to see it's still there. We don't want to see it like...
That's something we see every trip we come in from fishing. We see it going out, we see it coming in. That's part of a coming home thing there, looking at that.
Usually look forward to seeing that, right?
The lighthouses will be replaced by what are called skeleton towers, a steel tower with a light powered by solar panels. The actual navigation aid to boats will be maintained in this way. Dan Conlon is the curator of marine history at the Maritime Museum of the Atlantic.
This comes at the same time that the federal government passed an act to actually protect heritage lighthouses, which everybody thought would be a good way to set, you know, rational standards for landmark buildings. But it's then suddenly seems to have evolved into a way to get rid of a lot of lighthouses, which is not something that anyone expected.
The federal government has given the public 2 years to develop business plans to take over the lighthouses. That could mean turning them into everything from museums to bed and breakfasts. But Barry McDonald doesn't think there'll be many groups that can afford the offer. He's with the Nova Scotia Lighthouse Preservation Society.
You know, we just want a couple of these icons in each province, protected and partnered with community groups. But by declaring all the lights in Canada surplus, they've in fact pretty much absolved themselves of any kind of responsibility on a go-forward basis.
No one from the federal government would comment about the plans to get rid of the lighthouses. The Fisheries and Oceans website simply states in one section of its explanation, this move is cost-effective. Stephen Puddicombe, CBC News, Halifax.
And now to sum up, the focus of the upcoming G8 and G20 summits in Ontario is being watered down somewhat by the furor over a fake lake. The opposition calls it a national embarrassment. The government says the water feature is part of a marketing pavilion that will show off Canada to the world.
Calling all criminals, cell phones are a growing form of contraband inside Canadian prisons. Corrections officials say inmates use them to dial up drug deals, plot crimes, and even plan their escapes.
And that's our program for this Tuesday, June the 8th.
The World at 6 from CBC National Radio News. I'm Derek Stoffel.
And I'm Allison Smith. Have a good night.
Good evening.